On the evening of November 29, 2023, in MSU's Procrastinator Theater, the Heart Initiative at MSU, MSU Women's Center, Office of the Dean of Students, Voice Center, and MSU Police Department, along with the Bozeman Police Department, Haven, and the Sexual Assault Counseling Center, held a panel discussion on human trafficking in our community. The panel included Detectives Shea Stevens and Michael Mertz from the Bozeman and Montana State University Police Departments, and Sandra Schroeder of the Gallatin County Sheriff's Department, as well as Shea anti-trafficking legal advocate with Haven, and Perrin Lundgren, Help Center community educator with the Sexual Assault Counseling Center. Betsy Danforth, director of MSU's Women's Center, introduced the panel, which Chloe Zuroff, co-leader of the Heart Initiative, moderated.
My name is Betsy Danforth. I'm the director of the Women's Center here at MSU and also the faculty advisor for the Heart Initiative, which is a student organization focused on raising awareness about and hopefully helping to serve as a resource for people who are victim survivors of trafficking. We are very excited about tonight's talk, and we are super honored to have with us some of our law enforcement folks, some of our advocacy folks from the community who work very hard every day to help stop this very tragic and pervasive problem. And for those of you who may have read some stories in the news this summer, we asked if a couple of the detectives would come and talk to us about some of the cases that they have been working on here in the Gallatin Valley. I think a lot of times this is a topic that people kind of think it happens over there. Human trafficking happens in Asia and Africa, but it's happening right here in the Valley, so it's good for us to have more information about that and to know what's going on. We'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Heart Initiative, of course, and the Women's Center, Voice Center, and also the Dean of Students Office here on campus. Without them, we could not actually do these kinds of events, so it's great to have those resources here on campus as well. A big thank you to these awesome students who are the leadership of the Heart Initiative, Megan Mattioli. We've also got Talia, who has since graduated, but she was our leadership of Heart in past years. And then Chloe Zuroff, who is right here in front, who is graduating and leaving us like they all do. In any case, I will just pass the mic on to Chloe, and she's going to talk a little bit about tonight's panel.
Hello, guys. My name is Chloe, and I am a member of the Heart Initiative here at MSU. First, I would like to thank you all for taking time out of your Wednesday night to be here. I know that this topic is heavy, and I'm sure that there's a lot of other things you could be doing. So thank you, and I extend my gratitude to each of you. Secondly, I would like to give a brief introduction to our panelists over here. We have Mike Mertz, who is an SVU detective with Montana State University Police Department, as well as the Bozeman Police Department. And then Shea Stevens, a Bozeman Police Department SVU detective who investigates human trafficking, sex crimes, child abuse, violent crimes against persons. And then Sandy Schroeder, who with the Gallatin County Sheriff's Office, she investigates crimes against persons and is a Montana FBI Child Exploitation and Human Trafficking Task Force officer. And then we have two more individuals over here. We have Shay, an anti-trafficking legal advocate with Haven, and Perrin, a community educator with the Sexual Assault Counseling Center at the Bozeman Help Center. We have an immense amount of knowledge and experience on this panel, and we are looking forward to share some critical information with all of you. And to kick us off, Detective Stevens will give us a presentation on human trafficking.
Hello, how's everybody doing tonight? Oh, y'all are a rowdy crowd. Well, thanks for coming out. It's always nice to pass along any kind of education. Maybe you'll learn something new, maybe not. It's hard coming in and then not knowing exactly who all's going to be here and knowing what all topics I need to hit on. So I put together a couple things, and I'm going to try and go through it not too fast, but fast enough so that these guys can have a chance to talk, and then you guys ask some questions at the end. Okay, so to start, these are the lovely individuals I work with. The lady in the middle is Detective Casey Hansen. She is Internet Crimes Against Children. Mike Mertz is there on to you guys left with the on the left with the hat. Andy Kapler on the bottom left, and then Tom Lloyd bottom right, and then me right there. This is our group. We all work for the Special Victims Unit over at the Bozeman Public Safety Center. We all work different types of crimes and enjoy it. The guy that has the X on the face, his name's Dave Ferguson. He just retired and left us to pick up his caseload. So thanks, Dave. Basic overview of what we're going to be going over tonight. Overview of human trafficking. Who are the victims and traffickers? Recruitment. Barriers with human trafficking victims. Sex and labor trafficking. The T visa, which is a continued presence. We'll go into that later on. Human trafficking statistics, U.S. and globally. John, prostitution, human trafficking stings, prostitution lingo in Montana. And then what I can tell you about what happened in July, because those cases are still going through the criminal justice system. A warning, a lot of people use different words when it comes to human trafficking, prostitute, escort, sex worker. I'm not trying to offend anybody, but the terms I use is what I use whenever I'm working and working with different people. Pimp, trafficker, suspect, offender, victim, survivor. I might use those interchangeably, but typically I use victim because that's how we put our reports together, and that's how it gets sent off to our county attorney's office. And then lastly, Ruby. So you'll meet Ruby in a second. She is not a real escort. I created her, posted an ad on an escort website earlier today at about 11, just to demonstrate demand for sex workers in Montana. Since then, I've gotten 17 texts from Johns in Bozeman. If I get them whenever I'm up here, I'll just be like, oh, got another one. Or I'll just raise my phone so you guys know what I'm doing. But this is Ruby, and I got crosses on her face, and she's in lingerie, not nudity, but just FYI for the next page. Sorry if you guys get offended, but this is my work, and this is human trafficking, and this is the life. This is Ruby. She's my decoy prostitute for this PowerPoint. Here's some common human trafficking myths that I hear and address whenever it comes across, that human trafficking involves moving, traveling, or transporting a person across state or national borders. Doesn't have to be transporting somebody. You've got smuggling, or you've got trafficking just out of a house, out of a hotel, out of a car. If the trafficked person consented to be in their initial situation, then it cannot be human trafficking or against their will because they knew better. I don't like that sentence at all. Y'all can use your brain on why that one's wrong. People being trafficked are physically unable to leave their situations, locked in, held against their will. That's not always true. Sometimes people being trafficked are stuck in the situation for whatever reasons, and we'll go over that, but it doesn't mean that they're like locked to a bed or anything like that. Labor trafficking is only or primarily a problem in developing countries. No, that happens here in the USA. It happens in Gallatin County. It happens out in Billings. It's here in small town Bozeman. All commercial sex is human trafficking. That's incorrect. We get independent workers that have gotten out of the life and they're trying to make money and they're independent. People in active trafficking situations always want help getting out. Not true. A lot of these women close the door on us, don't want help. We leave our business card and try and offer any kind of resources we can. It may take several encounters before they're willing to accept help, and that could be from like prior law enforcement experience they didn't like, or they've been arrested, or whatever it is. What is human trafficking? It involves the use of force, fraud, or coercion in exchange for labor, services, or commercial sex act. Causing someone under the age of 18 to engage in a commercial sex act, regardless of using force, fraud, or coercion, is human trafficking under U.S. law. So I had a conversation with one of my coworkers a couple weeks back, because we were looking at, like, oh, this girl's 17, but she, you know, is of age to consent to sex. But we're like, well, maybe she's not, because what if she's being trafficked? And we kind of dabbed into that. So that's important to remember, age of 18 when it comes to human trafficking. Who are the victims? It can be anybody, any race, ethnicity, socioeconomic class, nationality, sex, gender identity, age, or any immigration status. Some common indicators of human trafficking, living with their employer, poor living conditions, multiple people in a cramped space. We've seen this with people renting out like Airbnb and VRBOs, and you walk into the house and then there's just like air mattresses blown up everywhere and people are staying in there. Answers appear to be scripted or rehearsed. Employees holding identity documents. So say you come here from another country and they're like, I want you to work with me, or I want you to do XYZ, and I'm going to hold on to your passport or your green card or whatever it is. And you can't have it back until you're done doing this, so people get stuck in those kind of situations. Signs of physical abuse, they're submissive or fearful, unpaid or being paid very little for what they're doing, under 18 and in prostitution, like we just said. These are similar to the indicators, but victim's behavior or physical state. They're acting anxious, depressed, tense, nervous, particularly around their work or someone that they know. Defer to another person to speak for him or her and avoid any eye contact. Showing signs of physical and or sexual abuse, physical restraint, confinement, or torture. Show signs of being harmed or deprived of food, water, sleep, medical care, other life necessities, or personal possessions. So something, like one of the first things when I'm talking to somebody that is potentially a victim of human trafficking, I'll introduce myself, shake their hand, can I get you any water, any food, see, you know, how they answer that, and then I'll be like, when was the last time you had a drink of water? When was the last time you had a meal? I talked to somebody yesterday, and they said the last time they had a meal was 2 days ago, so that's an issue. Something that I like to note in here, I like to say, no victim, no problem. If you have proof of a pimp or trafficker, you've got like forensic digital evidence on a phone or any kind of physical evidence, you don't need like cooperative victim. Like they might slam the door and say, F you, Detective Stevens, I don't want to work with you. But if I can get enough evidence to prove this person is being trafficked, then I can make an arrest or request charges for prosecution on that pimp. And that's different than our adult sex crimes. We have to have like a willing victim to go in and stand before a judge. Who's vulnerable? Recent migration or relocation, substance use, mental health concerns, foster care kiddos, runaway or homeless youth. Often traffickers identify and leverage their victims' vulnerabilities to create dependency. Common points of entry into human trafficking. I wish I would have put these in order, but I didn't, so they're there. Social circle, family, intimate partner, social media. So familiar trafficking, which is your family members trafficking you, that's your first one. Then your intimate partner, social circle, and then social media. So sorry for the mix up there. I didn't think about it until just now. I don't know if y'all are familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I saw this in a training I went to last year, and it made a lot of sense to me. So typically, this is in a triangle, starting with the bottom. So victims, the human body cannot function optimally if physiological needs are not satisfied. So a lot of people that are prime for the picking for victims are people that don't have water, don't have food, don't have shelter, don't have a place to live. And so these are the people that are most vulnerable. Once they obtain that, and then you start going up the list here with safety needs, love and belonging, esteem, and then self-actualization. And then pretty much when you get to the top, that's when you start seeing victims come out of being trafficked in the life. And they'll either go find a job, or it might be just, you know, world shock because they're not used to it. And then they'll be independent as a sex worker or go back and try and find a pimp that helps them out. Recruitment, they listen and pay attention, identify needs, hopes, and dreams, and then sell the dream or promise to fulfill the need. This one I like to think of like a Romeo and Juliet pimping situation. Like you meet a guy, he seems great, y'all fall in love. He does all these things that are up there, sells you the life, like, well, we need money to get to here, or money to get a house. Will you have sex with this person if I arrange it? Or will you go hang out at a casino or bar and start soliciting yourself and propositioning other men or women or couples? And that's how they end up getting recruited, and then they use them. Barriers for human trafficking victims. Trafficker convinces them they cannot make it without the trafficker. Prior attempts at leaving were unsuccessful. Feelings that they are so far behind, so no work experience or financial education. What I've seen with some people is they don't have any credit, no credit score, no nothing, because somebody's been controlling their money for however long, or they got really bad credit for that same reason, and so they just can't dig themselves out of that hole, and so the only job they know how to do to get money is to have sex with people. Cannot see any other means to survival. No access to resources, and we'll go over resources with advocates later on. Poor experiences with law enforcement, like I was saying earlier. A lot of officers in the U.S., and I'm speaking for myself when I was a younger officer too, you don't have this kind of training with human trafficking. You don't know the questions to ask, what to look for. you like miscode it as a domestic violence situation or whatever it is, and you don't dig deep with those kind of questions. And so for that, we miss a lot of the HT cases that come through. Not to bash on my fellow LEO, they're great, but like when I was younger, I didn't know until I got more training. Inaccessible housing and their coping mechanisms make it hard to live a straight life. Alcohol, drugs, all that kind of stuff. Public health focus on their health and well-being, figure out the why and how come instead of focusing on what, dig deeper, ask, don't tell victims what they need. That's anything people hate whenever you like try to shove answers down their throat, whenever they just need to be heard, and then offer them resources. Connect them with an advocate, community system, or community or system-based, or both. Plan for reentry and make it doable. Don't overwhelm them. If you give them a lot and a ton of resources, it might freak them out and they might want to run or get back to their old life because that's what they know and that's what they're used to. These are just like basic example questions to ask victims. At my office, I have pages and pages of stuff just for ideas and stuff to look into whenever I'm investigating. But this is stuff people like you guys, if you suspect your friend is being trafficked or a coworker or whatever it is, a student, can you leave your job if you want to? Can you come and go as you please? Have you been hurt or threatened if you tried to leave? Has your family been threatened? Do you live with your employer? Where do you sleep and eat? Last time you slept in 8. Are you in debt to your employer? Do you have your passport identification and who has it? Probably more common ones in Montana that I can think of with the, do you live with your employer? Like think illicit massage parlors and stuff, like workers that are in there. They work and work and you never see them leave. Like they're living there. They got beds, showers, so that's stuff to look into. That was a lot of victim-centered stuff. Here's who are traffickers, similar to victims of any race, ethnicity, gender, demographics, and as diverse as survivors. Some use their privilege, wealth, and power as a means of control, while others experience the same socioeconomic oppression as their victims. They include, like, think of any job you can. There's a bunch listed here. Business owners, members of a gang or network, parents, family members, intimate partners, owners of farms, restaurants, and powerful corporate executives and government representatives. How do they control their victims? Physical and emotional abuse. They threaten them. Isolation from friends and family. Economic abuse. They make promises aimed at addressing the needs of their target to impose control. And as a result, the victims become trapped in fear, leaving for many reasons, including psychological trauma, shame, emotional attachment, financial support, or physical threats to themselves or their family. I had a couple cases that involved the same person over the last year, the same trafficker, but different girls, and they all had the same isolation. The guy took their phones, gave them new ones, took their cars, gave them new ones, got them out of their apartment that they were living with their friends, put them in a new one. And then the friends and family are the ones that called in and were concerned about them. So that's the kind of isolation you can see. Them not wanting you to go out and hang out with your friends and family or talk to them because they'll probably say, you shouldn't be with this guy. Okay, this is a case that went nowhere because it was out of my jurisdiction. So there's curse words on here. This is lingo. The guy up top, he's a pimp. He was a pimp. He's in prison now. I think he's doing another 10 years, but all these people are like Ohio, Arizona, Vegas, Houston, Texas. So when the guy up top got sent to prison, the wannabe pimp was like taking control of the female underneath him to the left. She was trafficked when she was a child. Now she is a, what we call a bottom bitch. So that guy in the yellow coat tells her what to do, and then she goes out and she recruits other female to work men with her. So that was her job, and she travels from different cities and recruits girls to go have sex with guys, and they all get paid and make cuts out of it. The guy at the bottom, long story short, the guy in the yellow got arrested for domestic violence because he beat up this other girl, and then this guy came into the picture and he's like her new protector, and they travel together. But there's, what I've learned is there's no like acquaintances between men and women whenever it involves prostitution. He's getting a cut out of her having sex with guys. So this whole situation is terrible, but a lot of these cases will get more spider webs than what I have here. There's more people I could put on. He's another pimp, not in prison or jail. And then his bottom bitch is the girl underneath, and him and the other girl next to him worked together whenever they're in the same town and recruit other girls. So it's a lot of money to be made. People know it. This is business and money and trafficking, and it's not good. The trafficker on the top left and the girl on the left, they both got arrested for human trafficking down in, I think it was Arizona. They trafficked a runaway female out of South California whenever she was 14 or 15 at the time. So they got in big trouble for that. But she's back out and in the game again. These are wannabe pimps is what I am going to call them. They like to be flashy. They like the guns. They like their cash. I like the photo in the middle because their buddy had just gotten arrested and they were like hashtag free Brody, which I thought was pretty funny myself. And then they're posting all this kind of stuff. And I'm sure none of them are allowed to have guns because they all have criminal histories. But these are the kind of people, none of these guys are in Montana. But a lot of the women we see that come through town, they're running different tracks on the highway, and they're sending money back to their traffickers. Sometimes traffickers will be around here, or they're nearby, and they're watching and monitoring. Sometimes these guys, like the bottom bitches from the page before, they trust them and know that they're going to go make money and send it back to them. So they can sit, you know, on their couch at home and be getting Cash App and Venmo and Zelle and all that stuff, getting money back toward them, which is disgusting. I don't continue to presence. I've noticed not a ton of people know what this is, but it's really important when it comes to our investigations and illegal immigrants. Quick rundown of it. If we have a human trafficking victim, and whether it's labor or sex trafficking, and they're afraid, I'm going to get deported. I know that kind of stuff. This will protect them. It's a 2-year visa. As long as they're willing to cooperate with the prosecuting attorneys, it can get extended up to 4 years. But this is something I like to keep in my back pocket. If I'm talking to somebody and they're nervous or scared and they're like, I don't want to talk to you because I don't know if I'm going to get shipped back to wherever the next day, this is kind of a more make them feel comfortable, we can help you, that kind of thing. And this is listed on the Homeland Security's website, their whole pamphlet. Child sex trafficking in the United States. Average girl that's lured or forced into sex trafficking is just 15 years old. That is, like we discussed earlier, your foster kids, your runaways, your stepdad that wants to make extra money and wants to traffic his stepdaughter. Like, that's where you get this kind of stuff. Online forms of sex trafficking increased by more than 45% during the COVID-19 pandemic. 2020, the nearly 26,500 missing children reported to NCMEC, which is National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, who ran away. 1 in 6 were likely victims of child sex trafficking, which is another horrific number. 16% of the children who ran from the care of social services and were reported missing to NCMEC in 2019 were likely victims of child sex trafficking. 27% of sex trafficking cases reported to the National Human Trafficking Hotline number were instances of that family trafficking we were talking about, whether it's your mom saying like, hey, we need food tonight, you're going to go sleep with Joe next door, that kind of situation. 2018 survey of child sex trafficking victims, 55% of respondents reported being in school while they were being trafficked. I think that number can get better. It's just educating people, like just continue education and giving them examples and what to look for. And the same 2018 survey, 45% of respondents identified as Black or African American. Child sex trafficking is the fastest growing crime in the world. And 2014, sex traffickers raked in about $99 billion in profits. I can't even like think about counting to a million, let alone $99 billion. 21 million people are victims of forced labor and 4.5 million are trapped in the commercial sex trade. An estimated 900,000 to 1.2 million of those victims of commercial sexual exploitation are children, and that's globally. So John and prostitution stings. I hear like, why work these cases and put in all the time and effort? I hear it's just consensual sex between two adults. Why don't we arrest the prostitutes? We do arrest them on certain types of cases when we need to. Address demand, disrupt the market, deterrence, to put your footprint on human trafficking in Bozeman. I've had several people ask, like, why are we being more proactive? And why are you doing this kind of stuff? And it really is like, Bozeman's a sleepy town. Nobody's been monitoring it. When I got moved to detectives, this was a big thing I wanted to do. I'm just one person, but I'm trying to make a dent in it here. You never know if you could have prevented someone from being kidnapped, trafficked, drugged, robbed, raped, or physically assaulted. Prostitutes do get raped. People show up without money, use them. They get robbed a lot. A lot of this doesn't get reported because who's going to believe the prostitute is what they're thinking, or they've had terrible experience with law enforcement. or they're like, I am doing something illegal and I don't want to get in trouble. So we don't see a lot of those. When I've talked to prostitutes around town, this is the stuff I hear about, so it's an issue. Common escort websites in Montana, so y'all are going to see more of stuff I keep up with on a daily basis. Here's some, not all. There's always more being creative, but these are different websites traffickers are posting on, prostitutes are posting on, Tris, Mega Personals, One Back Page, Skip the Games, Adult Finder, Seeking Arrangements, Bumble, Tinder. There's more stuff. And this is what I tell patrol guys, too. Like, when you come across a John, how did they find the ad and contact? Where do they reside? Any kind of travel information, vehicle information, timeline of events? How long were they in the hotel room or the car, whatever it was, with this person? Phones and phone numbers, digital evidence is great. Financials, how did you pay this person? And then there are knowledge of prostitution terms and activity. You'd be surprised when you start going through a John's phone and they're using all of the lingo, which you're like, we both know what you're doing here. This is not like a common thing that people just know and type like. It's, no. And then the criminal history is good to know. So I actually have a 36-page document with all the different terms that have been collected and used. Y'all only get 20, but this is some of the stuff that we see. Number 18, a lot of people put like no black men or no AA for African Americans, and that's because a lot of people that are being trafficked, or if it's an independent prostitute, they don't want to run into another trafficker or have some kind of issue, and that's common for posts online. No explicit talk because they don't want people incriminating themselves. Number 20, some people don't put their phone numbers directly in the ad because you can search easier for that. I have other ways I can search that are faster from a law enforcement perspective, but to just other people, they don't do that. They'll spell it out weird. 10 and 11, donation and roses. It's like, how much donation? How many roses? How much for 30 minutes? How much of your time? That's where that comes in, the money part. These are common tattoos and meanings. A lot of the females I talk to, they've got roses tattooed on them. Again, money. I've only seen the barcode, that top left one time. There's actually an app where you can scan barcodes, and you can scan them off of people's bodies, which is interesting. Y'all will probably never have to do that in your life unless you come take my job someday. But you can do that. The crowns is another common one. Diamonds for money. Their trafficker or boyfriend's name tattooed on their body. This crown tattoo, she was being trafficked a couple years ago in Bozeman, and she has since gone. I haven't been able to get a hold of her since then. I'm not showing her face because she's from the case, but that's an actual tattoo from her hand. And then the whole property of that kind of stuff is common. I hate to be like a wah-wah. I can't talk to you guys too much about stuff that's not in an affidavit of probable cause or any kind of public information just because those cases are still going through the criminal justice system. Maybe in a couple of years when our CA's office gets caught up on cases, then I'll come back and we'll do a cool case review. But this was a John sting, so we wanted to arrest the buyers, and I wanted to arrest people that were there for human trafficking. So you see a lot of those higher numbers. It was like 18 arrests and one felony request for prosecution. But most of those are like patronizing a prostitute. So 17 of them were Johns that showed up, got arrested, caught him red-handed. There was one guy that got arrested because he had agreed to pay the prostitute an extra $50 to have sex with her 15-year-old sister. And so he caught a human trafficking charge for that. They're all important. They're all good cases. But the one human trafficking charge makes the whole weekend worth it because I put a lot of time into it and I'm still working some of those cases. But if we could just get one of those guys so that they can't perp or go after another, like an actual girl out there, it's totally worth it to me. So here's what an ad looks like. This is Destiny. This was my female for that op. And it's just basic information about what she's offering. And you see some of those lingos in there. Full service, Greek, BDSM, Mega Personals is another one. And then here's all the people that got arrested. So you see very different people. It's not just one type. They're all different ages, different races. none of them look similar. They're all very different, so you never know who's going to be around. Some of them have lengthy criminal histories, some of them don't. During the op, I seized over 70 grams of illegal narcotics, which is about 2.5 ounces. And then if you think user amount, like half a gram to 1 gram, if it's your first time doing like cocaine or fentanyl, that's a decent amount. So like 70 plus doses. Possibly stopped kidnapping. I won't go into that too much. And then intel of labor trafficking as well. Some of these guys talked, some of them didn't. Some gave really good information that I'm following up on. Again, I wish I could tell you. That's all I have. It's pretty brief, went over a couple different things, some stats, and maybe in a couple of years we can come back and I can give you some fun video and audio and stuff like that.
Thank you, Detective Stevens.
So we'll go ahead and get started with the panel questions. First off, I know I kind of briefly introduced you guys, but I'm wondering if you could go a little bit more into the work you do and what inspired you to get into it.
Hi, my name is Shay. I'm an anti-trafficking legal advocate for Hayden. In my job, I provide support to those who have experienced domestic violence, stalking, sexual assault, or sex trafficking. And as my legal advocate role, I provide support with filing an order of protection, parenting plan, or a dissolution when they are experiencing any of those four categories.
Hi, I'm Karen. I work as the counselor advocate, so I provide direct services to victims, survivors of sexual violence. And I've been doing that. I can't do math, so I've been doing that job since 2014. And so I've been working as a counselor advocate in that time. And since then, I've become the program manager of the Sexual Assault Counseling Center. So not just supporting victims and survivors, but also supporting the program as a whole. And then I also am the community educator. So I get to come out and be on panels like this and provide education about trauma and mental health and things like that.
I've been in law enforcement for 19 years. I think the job itself is like an adrenaline junkie job to start with. But now I'm too old and too slow to chase anybody. And just need it. So now I've been in detectives for about 3 years. And I think the big difference is putting people in prison versus just jail and protecting and helping the vulnerable, the folks that can't help themselves. So the undercover chatting and stuff that I do, I have different personas as a boy and a girl regarding chatting with folks. And when you arrest somebody who shows up to me to have sex with a 12-year-old, it's pretty rewarding. So that's what I do.
I'm Mike Mertz. I'm with MSU PD. I've been with MSU for about 5.5 years now. Before that, I was a law enforcement officer in Syracuse, New York. Did that for a few years. I've been in my current role with the SVU, which is a joint unit between BPD and MSU PD, for a little over 2 years now. A lot like Sandy said, it's very satisfying and rewarding when you get those individuals that are really causing harm to people. I do investigations into crimes against persons on campus as well as out in the city. I really view our campus community as just that, a big community. And I take those things very seriously. So being able to investigate things like sex crimes on campus, other felony crimes against persons, is very important to me. And I get a lot of satisfaction, kind of like Sammy said, out of that. So
I'm Shay. I've been with Bozeman Police Department since 2017. I've only been back in detective since February. I've wanted to put in for a while, but I had a kid, and that kind of like postpones things in life, especially when you're a female and law enforcement, like it happened to me. She's great though, my kid's great. But yeah, I investigate the human trafficking cases that come through Bozeman, mostly adult sex crimes, but I will take child abuse and child sex crimes as well, and then violent crimes against persons like stabbings and different things like that, and kind of gun violence. I got into law enforcement just because of some, not going to get into it, personal stuff that happened in my life whenever I was a kid or a teenager. And you know, I wanted to get into the criminal justice field at one point, but I always remember that officer that helped me out the first time, and I wanted to be that person to help people out. And long story short, I really like to put bad guys in jail, in prison, because we work felony cases, but that's pretty fun too.
Thank you. And then, so my next question is, if there is a typical case of human trafficking in Montana, what does that look like? And then in your experience, where is it happening most locally?
Where you see most of it, it's supply and demand. Like, there's demand in Billings because it's heavily populated. We see it in Bozeman because we've got a decent population. Great Falls, places like that. Montana, based on the prostitutes I've spoken to, it's kind of a place people come to. They make their money, and then they leave. They're here for a day or two, and we don't see them again. So a lot of these cases, we miss them just because we don't have the resources to proactively investigate every single thing that's going on in town. I wish we could, but we can't. The people that come and go, you're going to see, like, your pimp and prostitute kind of cases. The stuff we get around town, you might have, like, somebody running a brothel out of their house, which there have been a couple. Illicit massage parlors are another one. Billings was really busy with that, and a sergeant out of Waco, Texas, came up here and changed their city ordinances and kind of cleaned up the streets and the massage parlors, but then business moved outside of them, so you get that kind of stuff. And then, like, bad parent stuff, parents pimping out their kids or their stepkids, that's pretty common.
I guess another thing, too, is you'll see in Montana, like, farm work, livestock work, construction, things like that happen. It's more on the labor trafficking side than necessarily the sex work stuff, but that definitely still occurs, too, all throughout Montana, from here in Bozeman to Miles City and everywhere else, so that is something that also does occur.
My next question, leading off of that, what does labor trafficking look like in Montana, and do you think that sex trafficking or labor trafficking is more common locally?
I'd say we're probably more aware. I think the community is more educated on the sex stuff as a whole. Labor trafficking is hard. I would suspect with all the J-1s that work in West Yellowstone, and that's J-1 visas, in West Yellowstone and up in the club or Big Sky as a whole, there's probably a lot of that going on that we are just not aware of. Second language, you know, English is a lot of, not the first language of a lot of those folks working down there. They're living in small houses with tons of folks. Their employers are paying for their housing. That's how a lot of the, I'm going to call it the canyon, kind of just generalized to the canyon. It's expensive to live in the canyon, so employers are buying houses to put their folks up in, good and bad, but I have not worked like a labor trafficking, but it has to be happening here. I mean, I think it'd be ignorant to say it's not.
So. I can kind of mention also, so the Sexual Assault Counseling Center is a program under Help Center, Inc., and we answer the 24-hour crisis hotlines for 13 counties here in Southwest Montana, and we do receive contacts from individuals that report that their employer has their documents. And it's not always a passport or a visa or a green card. It's they took my driver's license, or we've gotten calls from traveling businesses. We've gotten a couple calls about, like, I took this job in, like, Minnesota or Arizona, and they said we were going to travel across the street and across all states and sell stuff, and now they've taken my documents, and I don't know what to do. And so we do get contacts on the 24-hour hotline about things like that, as well as with the Sexual Assault Counseling Center. We get contacts through our outreach. We respond 24 hours a day, similar to the Voice Center, to a sexual assault or intercourse without consent, medical exams at the hospital. And so in those moments, we see cases of human trafficking. And unfortunately, not very often, the victims, the survivors, don't identify themselves as being human trafficked. But because of our jobs, our education, our experience, we can see the signs that that's what's happening. And it kind of depends on their willingness to engage in services at that point.
So my next question is two parts. I'm going to start with the law enforcement folks. How frequently would you say that victims are cooperative in investigations?
On the human trafficking side, on my experience, a few cases where females were coming from out of town. I felt like the community team did a great job with the advocates. Due to some circumstances, this person wasn't allowed to keep their phone. The pimp came to the site, so he was basically overwatching. And we got our new phone, we got hotel, there's a bunch of different resources, clothes, and all kinds of stuff. By the next day, they were together, seen leaving town. So that's my limited experience with that particular pimp and that particular lady. But as a whole, I think they're stuck. I think it's hard. I think we have to keep trying. And if you can help one or two. And honestly, I may not know if we're helping, like, through the extent of the process, I guess, in the court system, but like, who knows what my interaction might have done, or Shay's, or the advocates, of just listening and intervening on that one day. Maybe that lady walked down the street that next day with that man, but then maybe a year later she had the epiphany. I don't know. I'll never know. But it's the what-if game, I guess.
I can remember a specific case. It was a male who had been arrested for, I believe it was indecent exposure or something like that, locally. His wife had come in. She was giving a lot of indications of human trafficking, specifically on the sexual servitude side, but would just hit a wall every time I would try to talk to her further about these things and get enough information to say, okay, I have enough to say that this guy is definitely trafficking. This female, she was from, I believe, Philippines. She was from rural Montana. There's just all these red flags, and I tried talking to her for hours, honestly, about the things that they had gone through together, and unfortunately, she just wasn't willing to get past that barrier and say the things that I knew or suspected to be true, but she just couldn't get to that point. So it is something that's extremely difficult for individuals in these situations to kind of get over that hurdle, but that's just been my experience.
Most people I contact, they don't want anything to do with me. They're packing up their suitcases and heading out before I can even hand them my business card. There was one time on patrol when I was still working, we had regular old traffic stop. His registration's expired out of Colorado, and the officer went up and approached and was like super, he was more looking into drug activity based on some red flags he saw, and then called me over to speak with a female because he had a female passenger, and then it started going into like, this could be drug trafficking, but this definitely looks like a sex trafficking thing to me. A female and her pimp that flew in, and a million red flags. Sometimes it's hard to identify human trafficking, like right when it's in front of your face, and then you have to look at totality of the circumstances and all the stuff we talked about earlier, like, when did you get here? How do you know him? How long have you known him? And, you know, separate them, get their stories, and then talk as officers together. She did not want any help. She said she had just met him, and they were on this huge road trip together, but that was another person that was like yelling and screaming at us because we were arresting her boyfriend for all the warrants he had. Shame on us, though, for arresting him for warrants. And then we started looking into the other stuff. But yeah, I haven't had great luck with victims appreciating our help, so we try. We don't know how much of a dent we're doing. Montana DOJ Division of Criminal Investigations agent Andy Yednock, he told me a story one time. He investigates human trafficking cases around the state. He handed a female this card. She left, and like a year later, she called him in California crying because she needed help and trying to get out of her trafficking situation she was in. So it may seem minimal, or we may be like, wow, we pissed that person off, but like we're saying, you never know if we could have helped them or how far along down the road one interaction can add up with other interactions to get them out. That's our goal.
And then on the advocacy side of things, what resources do you guys provide for victims?
So Haven as a whole, we have a shelter, we have a 24-hour line, we also have text and chat option 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., and then we have our legal advocacy, counseling, and support groups as well. With that, Haven provides voluntary services, and so in order to use our services, they would have to identify as being one of those four categories, experiencing domestic violence, stalking, sexual assault, or sex trafficking. And that is the first step, is identifying as experiencing one of those things. If we're able to determine that eligibility, then we can go forward with that person meeting with an advocate, getting community resources, and then as well as accessing all the resources that Haven as an organization can provide. Two parts to that is it is voluntary, and so they would have to identify as experiencing those things in order to reach those services. And I don't know if there is essentially services that are best in sex trafficking or human trafficking in general. I think it is on a personal basis, and so it's really what needs they're wanting to be met at that time, and what they're going to be open to getting information on. Again, we don't want to overload that information, but we do want to provide those services in case they were to want to use them.
So with the Sexual Assault Counseling Center, our advocates are available 24 hours a day. And so any person could call the hotline, and if they expressed or indicated that they wanted to talk about sexual violence or something that they experienced, the hotline staff are able to have a brief conversation to decide, like, this is sexual violence related, and an advocate is then connected with the caller. We provide all forms of advocacy, talking through the situation, counseling services. We provide both short-term crisis counseling and long-term crisis counseling. We do provide outreach services, so if an individual enters the emergency department seeking services because of sexual violence, sexual assault, sexual intercourse without consent, an advocate is contacted and we respond to the hospital, where we then connect with them and explain who we are and get consent to be present. And then we help explain the process of an exam and what that can look like, options available to them. And I think with human trafficking in particular, sex trafficking even more specifically, the goal is to kind of, as Shay said, meet them where they're at. And so if they don't want to identify or aren't in a place where they are identifying that they're experiencing human trafficking, we meet their needs that they're requesting. So if they're saying, I need help with a bus ticket, or I need help with food, or I need help with these things, we will be present and help coordinate that, like finding the resources in town that can help with those things, or helping them relocate to the place where they feel safest, and doing assessments to make sure that we're not just sending them right back to the person that's hurting them. Our hope, I guess the goal of that, is by meeting them where they're at, they will receive services and support, and then maybe in a week down the line, they'll say, this person met me where I was at, maybe there's someone that I can check in or talk to about this thing. So the hope is that by meeting them where they're at, they can then re-engage with us in a way that feels safe for them.
My final question, I know...
Can I interrupt? I got a question. You have some wonderful reactive approaches when you see it happening, but as a parent and a community member, I want to know, like, what can the public do to make a dent, make a difference? How can we come alongside you? That's my first question, because I've got lots of parents and peers that are indignant because of sex trafficking. We want to help. We feel helpless. The second question I have is, what do I tell my daughter? Okay, I want to know some upstream solutions.
Yeah, and that actually covers my next question. If the general public suspects human trafficking, what should they do?
I've been coining this little phrase, but if you see something, don't just say something, do something. And that doesn't mean to go make like a citizen's arrest, tackle people and hold them down for us. That's if you can discreetly take photos, license plates, give us good descriptions of individuals, where they're headed to, what time. A lot of the cases I get don't come to my desk until like a week after they were reported, and that's just the way our cases get sent to detectives, and it's too late for us to get to them because they're here, and then they're on a plane, or they're up in Missoula or somewhere else, and I can't track them because it's outside of my jurisdiction, or I can try, and I don't know where they're at. They're here and they're gone, and I can't identify them. Something that would have helped us a lot that actually became illegal this summer is artificial intelligence, and I used a couple of programs that were awesome whenever it was still legal, and it was able to like scan faces or pictures, and I could identify them like, whoop, here they are, just using public sources, resources, and we were able to identify people and talk to them, but that is out, and so we're like starting from ground zero, and our cases take a lot longer to process. For parents, one of the guys that was on that SVU photo, his name's Tom. He is always nervous about his daughter because he has got a teenager, and it's just, the scary thing is your phones, right? A lot of these teenagers, they're on TikTok, Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, unless Facebook's old now, MySpace back in my day, and random strangers are reaching out to you, you don't know what they look like, but they know all about you, then you vent to them like, oh, I got in trouble today and I'm mad at my parents and yada yada, and then they give you a shoulder to lean on and support you and like, hey, which school do you go to? Let's go to McDonald's for lunch or whatever it is. And the next thing you know, you're meeting up with a stranger. He's an older guy. There's all these red flags, but they don't see it because when you're in high school, it's just like you do dumb stuff, which I did as well. So I get it. You don't make the smartest decisions and you're hanging out with strangers you don't know. And then you start to do alcohol, drugs, Paco, and you start sleeping with them, and you start sleeping with the guy over there to get drugs for you and your new boyfriend to have. That's like a lot of our stuff stems from those kind of cases. And it's a great thing that we have other detectives that are doing like online child predator stings and trying to catch those kind of guys so that your kids are not victimized. So I applaud people that do that kind of work, because it's like Sandy, you don't just text chomos from 7 to 5 Monday through Friday. Like, you gotta talk to them at nighttime, you gotta talk to them on the evenings, you gotta have your own social life. So it's hard, but that's something she's trying to do to help prevent your kids from being victims to anything like that. But yeah, most of my cases, anything that comes, it's like, I need more than just a brief description. I need photos and stuff to track down people. So we go do bank talks, hotel talks, school talks to educate those people, because a pimp isn't going to let you control your own money. They're going to go up, go through the drive-thru, the ATM, or walk into the bank with you, and you're going to be looking down, and this guy's going to be taking control of everything. So we do go around and do talks to try and educate those kind of people too. With parents, it's just look for those signs I explained earlier with the isolation. Make sure their phone is safe. Like, they're so scary. We see it. Most of our cases have to do with social media, I would say, and bad things happening.
I think a big thing too is teaching resilience, not falling into manipulative relationships and things like that. We live in a very different time. Like, we're constantly evolving, right, in our relationships and how we communicate with people. And a majority of these kids these days, they're talking on their phones. It's all on Snapchat, and those things are difficult to control as a parent, right? But teaching your child to have resilience in the relationships, to make sure that they don't fall into the bad crowd, not to be too generic, right? But to make sure that they don't get into those sort of relationships that end up deteriorating into situations that could lead to human trafficking. That includes making sure that drugs and alcohol stay in check, right? At MSU specifically, we take a very hard stance on drugs and alcohol, because those are the source of so many problems that we have across the board, whether it be misdemeanor criminal mischiefs all the way up to, you know, sex crimes. So we take those things very seriously, and we mitigate those. And we see directly that when we take a hard stance on drugs and alcohol, we see a direct relationship with the number of alcohol and drug-related crimes, specifically sex crimes and felony crimes, they go way down. So making sure that, you know, as a parent, you're keeping an eye on those sorts of things. Because those addictions, they're serious, and when they start young, it's so much worse. I mainly work child sex crimes, so a lot of the cases I see, almost all of them, have some sort of drug and alcohol factor and relationship factor, where there's some sort of manipulation going on, control, those sorts of things. So I would say that those are probably the two big areas that I would focus on as a parent to try to mitigate, you know, your children falling into these sorts of situations.
Since not everybody is a parent here, but I would just pay attention and don't use the phrase, it's not my problem, right? So if you just ask somebody if they're okay, ask if you can help, or if you see something weird, everybody's got a recording device and a camera on them almost all the time. Take pictures. I mean, don't intervene. That's not your guys' lane. But, like, if you got somebody who is a coworker who's having trouble, like, ask questions. Don't just assume it's somebody else's problem, I guess. And as for dealing with your teens, as somebody who, I go through phases of doing a lot of chatting. I would say I'm not in that phase right now due to other workload. But it's easy. It's so easy to, like, hook a predator. My training is to, like, be vulnerable. Like, oh, mom's being crazy, so I'm staying at my aunt's, or I got kicked out, so I'm at grandma's, or like, man, you say anything like that, I got somebody on the hook, like, in seconds. So you guys know who those people are in your circle that need an extra hand, or maybe things are different at home. Just pay attention, ask questions, and care, I think. And then report to law enforcement. I mean, we get a lot of reports that there's not enough information for us to do with. Maybe not today, but some other little piece of information comes in from somebody else tomorrow, and we're able to tie some of those things together to put a case together. So you never really know what your small little piece might add to, like, a bigger picture.
Just, like, creating awareness. So I think sometimes sex trafficking, labor trafficking, sex crimes, violent crimes, things like that, we sometimes don't think about them as happening around us. And so just having conversations, practicing awareness that these things do happen in every community, regardless of the size. And so having that awareness, creating that awareness in your friend groups, your family, places like that, because then they will maybe notice something or they will pay attention. When it comes to, like, as a parent for teens, I work a lot because you're learning so much about all the jobs that I do. I work at the Gallatin County Child Advocacy Center with Mike all the time. We provide services to children who have already experienced something, and a part of that is having conversations about how to set boundaries as a parent, but then also how to teach your kid how to recognize their own boundaries, right? How to notice when a person is maybe crossing a boundary and knowing what that is and how to hold them or how to say, like, that's a boundary.
And then as far as, like, community outreach, Haven does a lot of community outreach with school-aged individuals. We also hold peer education classes. I will be presenting some information on sex trafficking and human trafficking in general at a peer education group in January.
What do you do with those hits?
This tonight was just an example to show you guys the demand for it in Bozeman, because a lot of people don't know about it, and I feel like that's a great way to show people in real time that there's that kind of business running around here. If I am doing, like, say I've got, like, a ton of cases right now, but if I have time and my coworkers are free as well and they aren't super, super busy, I can ask if, hey, let's go arrest some of these people, set them up at a hotel, or you could do them at, like, anywhere with a parking lot, stuff like that. So it's a felony crime now as of April of 2023, so we can arrest patronizing a prostitute. I also keep, like, an Excel spreadsheet of everybody that reaches out to me, because I have different rubies that run around the U.S. in different areas in Montana. I keep them on a loop and bring them back so I can use them when I do different stings. Ruby's going to be taken off the market tonight, so I don't mess with my phone or anything like that. I'll change my phone number and everything. It's used to try and catch Johns or traffickers. It's like, hey, I'm not free, but I have this other girl. Or, like, hey, you're going to need to talk to my pimp, whatever it is. Some people are down with that. You'd be surprised. But if it's something when I'm pretty busy and we get, like, a trafficker on the hook, then I would stop whatever and ask, like, Mike or whomever to come help me out. So that's what it's there for. It's just another investigative tool. I won't go into too many details of that, because I gotta keep some secrets. So I don't go around telling people. But yeah, tonight it's just to show you guys what's going on. And my phone, if I don't turn it off by 10, will probably be blowing up until 3 in the morning.
You have these sting operations. We see them nationwide. I think back to all our Dateline NBC sting operations week after week, every Friday. What's your thoughts on the sting operations as a deterrent, and do you need media coverage of those to be a deterrent? I mean, coming off of July in little old Bozeman, clearly there's still a demand. You wonder, is it just they're willing to take the risk that it's real?
Yeah, so a big part of that was to make a big splash and cause a deterrence, address demand, and let the public know about what's going on here, because you do want it to be a deterrent and to keep people out of here, because I'm trying to, like, keep Bozeman safe, and to got people that are wanting to reach out to victims of human trafficking and to get them off the streets, of course. Yeah, so it was a little slow for a couple weeks, and then I was like, oh, I'll throw some ads up and see what kind of business I'm getting. And it was just, like, crazy again. So I could do this stuff as a full-time job and make a bunch of proactive arrests. But like I said earlier, I'm one person. I can't do it all. I take all these other cases that aren't even human trafficking cases. So sometimes it's hard to just work proactive cases, because crime didn't stop in here in this town. And these guys are super busy, too. So we would love to, and to try and, be better and keep it out of here more. But it's just hard.
My fiance is from Talent, Oregon, which burned down a couple of years ago. And Medford conducted a sting through the federal aid program for people who were impacted by the fire. They put out food and water, and illegal immigrants came to collect the food and water just like everybody else did. And then they arrested those people and sent them over to ICE to deport them. So my question is there a sanctuary policy? Because that's why I came here tonight, is for the labor trafficking. That's something that my office receives a lot of. Spanish-speaking people come to us, and for context, I'm a criminal defense attorney, and they talk to me because they don't want to report it to police. And I didn't think of this until you started talking about it, but is there a sanctuary policy where I can direct those people to contact you and not have a fear of being deported, reporting, say, the crime of labor trafficking, which I find to be rampant? I get a ton of these calls because we speak Spanish, and we try to send letters to the employers to get them their money or fix the situation, but there's only so much I can do. I don't carry a big stick. So my question is, if there's a sanctuary policy with, usually the sheriff's office is the one who would be dealing with this, but also Bozeman PD.
Not personally aware of the policy. I would speak on behalf of, like, the office as, like, a whole. Is I think there would have to be something else going on for ICE to be notified on almost any crime in our detention center. Either other wants from somewhere else or other knowledge of different crimes. But I have worked with persons who have been victims of crime with a T visa. It's a ton of work, not only from, I think it's like the state DOJ or the federal DOJ that's supporting those persons, but like the document is like this long, elaborate thing. I would love to get you the answer on, like, I have not seen something written down from either the county attorney's office or from my own office. But I know that's been a conversation before, is not going after victims. Like, even if it's a domestic violence, let's make it more narrow, and there's a driving while suspended warrant. Like, our goal would not be to take the victim of a domestic violence to jail on a warrant. So, I mean, as a whole, that would be a practice. But as, like, where something very definitive that you're asking for, I've never seen that.
We've had the same thing happen with potential victims and victims of sex trafficking, where we've been contacted by people who don't want to get in trouble. So maybe there's a policy with that. Or how do I advise these people on how to approach law enforcement? We're in the same business, two sides of the same coin. I like to think about it. And with people who are in these situations, I want to be able to advise them appropriately without getting them in trouble. Because I have advised somebody to report to law enforcement, and they got charged. There's a lot that goes into that. I'm not saying it's the prosecutor or the law enforcement's fault. But it would be nice to be advised on that side of the issue as well.
Yeah, so we don't have anything set in stone, like, policy-wise, like, sanctuary stuff you're talking about. And it's the same thing. Like, is the juice worth the squeeze, how's it go? And a lot of the times when I've interacted with illegal immigrants on cases, call ICE, and they're like, oh, like, we'll put them on our list. But, like, if it's not a violent crime, is what I get all the time, then we're not going to do anything with it. And that's my experience for years contacting the same guy. And he's like, yeah, no, not unless it's something violent.
Whereas I've had people reported to DUIs, and no pending investigations that I'm made aware of. So I want to push back on that. I need assurance to be able to send people your way who are going to give you perhaps good information, because I don't specialize in cooperation, but some of my associates do.
And I, Herman, I'll get with you after this and give you another contact that would be beneficial for you and those. That's a guy that I work with that's at the state level that would probably be able to answer that a little bit better. I, like, with victims of whatever kind of crime it is, I've never jammed them up on anything like that. Typically, they do go to jail, though. I believe they call ICE and let them know if they can't get some type of identification for them, or they don't have an ID, or they're sending photos to people like, who is this person? So we can't figure out who they are, which happens a lot. But yeah, I wish I could give you that reassurance, but I'll give you that contact so we can figure that.
I'm just curious, you guys might not know this, and I'm sure I could look this up. Comparatively to other countries, particularly other developed countries, where do we sit in, like, rates of human trafficking? Do other developed countries have, like, the same amount, more, less?
I can speak a little bit to that because I focused my senior capstone on that. In my research, I found that the United States is one of the leading producers and consumers of human trafficking.
I've got a friend who volunteers with Bienvenidos, which is an organization built around welcoming Latino-speaking citizens. And they have had a lot of reports of those folks talking about being trafficked and not being paid and all those issues. Is there kind of any forward thinking or interfacing with law enforcement and your services and Bienvenidos? I don't know how. I know they're a pretty new organization, but I don't know if there's any interface with all of your groups that might be helpful.
Yeah, I work with Bienvenidos. Yeah, I work with Bienvenidos all the time.
Okay. How often do the advocacy organizations that you two work with get in contact and work with law enforcement organizations?
When the survivor, when the victim wants to. So a person can enter our services and we are confidential and private. And when that individual is ready to report to law enforcement, we help facilitate that communication, that contact. So when a person is ready, we will be with them in that process.
It's pretty much the same with Haven. So we have really strict confidentiality, and so we cannot confirm or deny that we're working with anybody to anybody else, and that even includes law enforcement unless we have the participant's written consent. If they are wanting an advocate to be present to make that report, that is definitely something that we can provide. And then in my role as a legal advocate, I attend court hearings with those who have experienced harm for orders of protection, and then also provide hearing prep for those order protection hearings and parenting plan and dissolutions as well.
Well, I think there's a little bit more to that in each situation. Stuff that comes to the emergency room will always contact, for the most part, law enforcement and advocacy. So I feel like we work side by side there. Anytime that we're doing interviewing children at the Child Advocacy Center, there is always an advocate. There's always an interviewer, law enforcement, Child Protective Services, and an advocate there. We have a monthly multidisciplinary team, which is composed of 7 entities, being medical, advocates, interviewers, CPS, law enforcement, the county attorney's office. So MDT is protocol set in place on how to handle child abuse stuff. And the reason is we only want to interview victims once. And so when we do an interview at the Child Advocacy Center with a child, we want to have all partners who would possibly need information to be there to witness it the first time, because it's very rare that we would do a second interview with a child. Adults are different. We can do follow-up questions and reach out to them, but children are definitely different. And then SART is the adult side of that team, sexual assault response team. And we also meet and basically make sure we cross-reference information. Parent might get information on a phone call that she needs to share with law enforcement, or, hey, is this going okay, or what can we do better? So I feel like I know Parent all right, and we spend quality time together.
Have you guys seen, with the increase of demand for desire for these things and the increase of the human trafficking, that have you also seen an increase in, like, single incident, non-grooming, abduction, rape? Is that separate, or has that number also gone up?
Is your question more related to, like, stranger?
Yes. Total stranger incident of abduction, sex violence, rape.
I would say that's rare in my experience. I'll let Mike speak.
On campus might be a little different.
Yeah, it's much the same. As any community grows, you're going to have more and more crimes. Violent crimes against persons are no exception to that. But really, those sorts of things are pretty rare. They're extremely rare on campus specifically.
Very rare for Bozeman PD side. We get a lot of calls for service, like, there's this creepy guy driving around in a truck around, you know, whatever park or whatever school that it is. A patrol gets sent out. They stop them, like, hey, what's going on here? And like, oh, I don't want to sit outside, I'm just watching my grandkid play or whatever it is. And then all of that is, of course, double checked, because we'll just believe something somebody tells us all the time. And I talked to our police information specialist about this, because he reviews all the calls for service for like the week and will let us know kind of what's going on if we don't already know. And he's like, we get so many of these park ones and people nervous that kids are getting abducted, but we don't see that. I'd say it's super rare. Now that I've said that, hopefully it doesn't happen. I'm super superstitious.
I would say for our participants, people who enter services, the overwhelming majority are acquaintance, peer, friends, family, are the offender or the perpetrator of violence. It's very rare for it to be a stranger or a non-known person. It could be a known person, and like, this is someone I knew or I met a week ago in class, and then I saw this person this, and then that. So it's typically a known person.
Which is interesting, because like, as a society, I think we all teach like stranger danger, mm-hmm. right? It's not like, watch out for Uncle Jimmy. My conversations are harder maybe to have, weird, but like, that's the truth, is to watch out for creepy Jimmy.
And our generation of stranger danger and the groupies, right? And the parties, and the girls getting things dropped in their drink and being aware of multiple rape situations, to now maybe they just learned the more brilliant tactic of the familiarity of relationship. But I was curious about the correlation, you know, because it seems like we don't hear about that stuff anymore. We just hear about the sex trafficking.
As a student a couple of years ago, I heard countless times of people getting roofied in date rape drugs and that kind of thing. The bars around Bozeman, parties and whatever else, and I'm sure that's, as a college kid, you know, that's what people my age group are engaging with. But I'd love to know how often on the law enforcement side are those drugs coming into play with human trafficking,
then also on the advocacy side, how often do you see that with the cases that you work? And then from both groups, what's being done to combat that?
Most of my cases are like 18 and up, rape cases, sex assaults. I take a lot of cases where it's like, I think I was roofied, all this kind of stuff. They go to the hospital, they get all the tests done, ends up just toxicology coming back as alcohol related. And I preach this to everybody. I've got a younger brother in college, I've got younger cousins in college, and it's like alcohol is the biggest known drug. Watch out for it. I haven't had any actual roofie cases that have come back. We submit stuff to the crime lab, and you have to do that in a timely manner, and some of them, we get them real quick, but nothing ever, for me, has come back. The guy's job, he's now our sergeant. He worked the same kind of cases, same caseload as I do now, and he will say the same thing, and he worked this job for way longer than me. So I also grew up in the world of, like, be careful of roofies, like, I went to college, all that kind of stuff, but most of the time going to be you're drinking too much alcohol, getting put alcohol by somebody, and then getting sexually assaulted. So that is my professional opinion on it.
I take a lot of these cases on campus. I get reported, and much like Shay said, I can only recall one specific incident where there was actually some drugs that were found in a tox screen that came back. It's almost always overconsumption of alcohol. And whether that's somebody that is maybe being pressured by somebody else to have too much alcohol, or maybe they didn't eat that day, they consume more than a normal amount. There's so many different factors that go into it. But from where I sit, it's almost always an overconsumption of alcohol. But there is that correlation between drug use and human trafficking that's ever prevalent. You get somebody hooked on drugs if they're maybe even the supplier of the drugs to somebody who then has that need for them, will pay for them by any means, and that's a slippery slope into Shay's world here. So there's definitely that connection there.
It might be happening more than we know because the screenings, hospital may not always screen for it or capable of screening for it. And then the timeline of when did they get a blood draw to submit something to the crime lab. Alcohol stays in your system longer than most GHB stuff, so we could be missing stuff that may have happened, for sure.
Just echoing that, a lot of the drugs that we associate with, like, sexual assault or date rape-facilitated drugs, they leave the system really quickly, and sometimes that they can be almost all the way out of the system by the time the person is realizing what happened to them. And then they go, they get tested, and it doesn't show up. We do see a lot of alcohol-facilitated sexual assaults, and that is the situation of someone feeding someone or a person being told, like, oh, it's just this, but there's more in it than what was anticipated, things like that. And so we see that a lot. And then in human trafficking, drug-facilitated is a way that people exploit. There was a situation, someone that I knew actually personally, they were trafficked by a family because they were addicts. They were using, and so they told their child, we need money. You don't come back home until you make money so that we can use substances. And then they got the child hooked on substances, and it became this cycle. And it was family, so it ended up being generational more than just one generation, it was two that this process had been passed down. And so drug-facilitated human trafficking is a thing that happens probably far more common than we think. But then also any kind of ability to exploit, right? Like, you don't have a place to stay, you don't have food, you don't have any way that a person could exploit, becomes a situation where you could traffic someone through exploitation like that.
I'm curious, do you guys believe that there is a correlation between the rise in pornography and the way that media is portraying violence, excessive, the rise of that being portrayed in our media? Do you believe that there's a correlation between that and the rise in sex trafficking?
I think I'll just speak as, like, a human and not as a cop and say it probably has to, but I don't have any science for that.
Yes, same sort of perspective. I mean, if you think about it, this stuff is so accessible to anybody that has a cell phone. I didn't have a cell phone until I was a teenager, you know, well into those years. Kids these days, they have cell phones, iPads at really young ages. It's so accessible, so easy to get. And yeah, there are parent parental controls and things, but kids are smart. They'll find ways around them. So you will see kids that are 8, 9, 10 years old getting access to these things. It's got to have some sort of impact. But again, I don't have any data to support my theory here.
And then Something else I've seen with every prostitute I've talked to is OnlyFans. If y'all know what that is, people can sell videos of themselves online, which are pornographic, or people will show their knees and get paid for it, but it's also more sexualized, and they make a ton of money on that too. But that's something that's like been on Instagram and a fad, and like, hey, I'm making X amount of money on OnlyFans, come check me out, and all that's advertised on social media to access that. So that's just a little bit different twist than what they said, but I've seen that directly impact people and how they're making money. Sometimes traffickers will make them, like, yes, have sex with people, but also sexually exploit them online in front of the cameras, and that's pornography, that's your OnlyFans, everything like that. They're getting taken advantage of because they want to make money.
Well, again, thank you all for coming. I hope you have a safe and warm evening, but have a good night.
You have just heard a panel discussion on human trafficking in our community that was held in the Strand Union Building's Procrastinator Theater on the evening of November 29, 2023. Moderated by co-leader of the Heart Initiative, Chloe Zuroff, the panel included detectives Shea Stevens and Michael Mertz from the Bozeman and Montana State University Police Departments, and Sandra Schroeder of the Gallatin County Sheriff's Department, as well as Shea, anti-trafficking legal advocate with Haven, and Perrin Lundgren, Help Center community educator with the Sexual Assault Counseling Center. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman. KGVM is staffed solely by dedicated community volunteers and depends entirely on our listeners to provide the funds necessary to keep this station on the air serving our community. You can do your share to help keep this radio of, by, and for our community thriving and continuing to bring you events such as this one by going to kgvm.org and click on the gold KGVM button at the top of the page. KGVM is a 501c3, so your contribution is tax deductible to the fullest extent of the law. We thank you for listening and for your support.